This is the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks on KQV with expert advice from CPA, attorney, and retirement and estate planning expert Jim Lang, best-selling author of Retire Secure and The Roth Revolution, Pay Taxes Once, Then Never Again. Now on air and worldwide, paytaxeslater.com. Now get ready to talk smart money.
And welcome to the Lang Money Hour. I'm Dan Weinberg, along with CPA and attorney Jim Lang. With Tax Day, April 15th, fast approaching, tonight we're going to bring you some tips and techniques on how to legally and ethically reduce your income taxes. And we can't think of a better person to provide you with insider tax saving secrets than today's guest, former IRS attorney, syndicated writer, and best-selling author, Sandy Botkin. For more than 20 years, Sandy has taught thousands of taxpayers how to save millions on their taxes through his seminars and lectures. Today, he's the chief executive officer and primary lecturer of the Tax Reduction Institute, a tax education company that creates and distributes valuable tax information to independent contractors and small businesses. And his latest book, Lower Your Taxes Big Time, is brand new for 2015. So with that, let's say hello to Jim Lang and welcome back to the program to Sandy Botkin.
Welcome, Sandy.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on.
And we don't want to forget your other book that, even if it's not your newest, is probably relevant particularly for people who are not in business for themselves and just say investors, is Achieve Financial Freedom. Again, that's Achieve Financial Freedom in addition to Lower Your Taxes Big Time by Sandy Botkin, B-O-T-K-I-N. And I will tell you, as a CPA and an attorney, Sandy is right on top of things that sometimes we don't think about. And frankly, he has, I don't want to use the word balls on the air, but he goes for it, man. And he justifies it and says it with a straight face, and it gives people the ability really to deduct a lot of things that they might not otherwise deduct. So, Sandy, one of the things, and very frankly, when I was preparing for this show, I thought, you know, most of the people, most of our listeners are probably, they have a job, or maybe they're retired, and we really shouldn't talk about, we shouldn't spend a lot of time on being self-employed. And then your first chapter, you know, you have to be brain dead not to start your own business. So I thought, how can I skip that? Can you tell us a little bit about starting your own business, both from an economic standpoint and then also from a tax standpoint?
You know, it's good that you brought that up, because that's really the genesis behind where people can really save money in taxes. What's interesting is that most people don't realize is that we have two tax systems in this country. And when I say that, a lot of people think, oh, sure, one for rich and one for poor. And that is not true. There's one to make you rich, and there's one to make you poor. And I guess it's the question of which one do you want to be in. The one to make you poor, unfortunately, is designed for the employee and the working stiff, those that don't have a business. Because you are taxed on dollar one, you basically don't get that many deductions, despite what you may think. And if you do get an employee business expense, it's got to exceed a certain threshold. In fact, even worse, if you take too many employee business expenses, then you get stuck in something called alternative minimum tax, which disallow those things. However, if you are self-employed, that's the one to make you rich. And that's true whether it's full-time or part-time. It doesn't matter. You can write off everything that an employee can write off. You can write off part of your house, your spouse, the equivalent of your kids' education and weddings. I'm not exaggerating when I say that, by the way. You can set up a pension plan that makes any government plan looks small by comparison. Like there's one plan I'm thinking of, you can put away $210,000 a year, believe it or not. The tax benefits of being in business are enormous. You get your deductions before the government gets one dime to drink. You're not taxed on dollar one like an employee. You don't get hit with alternative minimum tax. It doesn't eliminate your deductions. I mean, it's just enormous. And even better, let's say your business generates a loss. As long as you have the right documentation and that you're trying to make money, you're running your business like a business, that loss can be used against any form of income you have. I mean, the government's probably the biggest bookie in North America because they let you write off any loss from a business against any earnings. So let's say you're making $50,000 in a job. Instead of working overtime for that boss, which, by the way, is spelled backwards, double S-O-B, you get a part-time business and generates a $10,000 loss. You only pay taxes on the net, which is 40. And if that loss exceeds your whole income for the year, you're a single parent, you get to carry it back 2 years and offset the last 2 years of taxes that you paid, or carry it forward 20 years and offset the next 20 years of earnings. Now, you ask me, why would a government do this? And here's the answer. The U.S. government has learned something that most other countries haven't learned. And we're sort of getting away from it, unfortunately. But for years, we've learned this. And what we've learned is from little acorns come big trees. For example, Apple Computer didn't start with 200,000 employees. It started out of Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs' garage. The big internet giant Amazon didn't start big. It started out of Jeff Bezos' garage. So the government passes good tax laws for small business. The key is you want to take advantage of them because the benefits are enormous, and you can use those, and you can use losses from that business to offset what you're earning as an employee. So it's well worth getting a side business. The key is to try to find something that you think you can make money at.
Well, let's say that I'm a listener and maybe I'm driving to my job or I'm driving to church on Sunday morning and I'm thinking, hey, you know, I have my job, things could be better, but I really don't want to, you know, I have a mortgage and I have a kid in school, which we'll get to later. I really can't afford to be without the income of my job. What do you think about, let's say, starting something on the side, which, by the way, is how I got started. I started doing tax returns on the side, and then I went to law school, and eventually I had enough business that I didn't have to work for anybody, and I've been self-employed ever since. What do you think about somebody starting small in a, let's say, in a situation where there isn't a huge amount of risk? Like, you don't have to buy a building and or rent an office and hire 20 employees, do you?
No, you know, you're absolutely right about this. I mean, there's no reason why you should absolutely quit your job. That's not what I'm saying. And then go, you know, with full risk and go out in the business. I mean, that to me is very stupid. Unless you get a lot of funding from somebody, because you're going to need funding not only for the business, but you're going to need funding for your lifestyle while you're building that business. Everybody forgets about that. No, I would recommend, you know, if you have a job and making money, I would recommend on the side starting that side business, doing exactly what you said. You have much less risk. You're still providing the money for your lifestyle as well as your business, and just slowly build it up. Eventually, not only do you get some great tax benefits, but eventually you might make enough money where you can quit that job and do exactly what you did.
And the other thing
but
that
it takes more, it takes drive, and it takes persistence, and it takes time.
Well, the other thing that I liked is you didn't say, hey, just start a random business about something that you don't know anything about. You basically said, you know, you're probably better off doing something that you like and that you know.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you don't necessarily have to physically know it. You can investigate it, do some investigation, which is one of the criteria that IRS looks at as to whether you're running your business like a business. But you can investigate it. There's a lot of franchises that are very successful, and you can look into those. I mean, there's a guy I know who was an employee selling carpets. He didn't want to do that anymore. But he went to this one restaurant somewhere where he got the best pancakes he ever had in his life and best breakfast he ever had in his life. And he said, I'm going to open up a franchise. So he opened up what is called an original pancake house. This place is so busy, he's opened up two others since then. And the guy, he doesn't have to work again for the rest of his life. You can look into things. There are plenty of franchises out there. There are some very good network marketing opportunities out there. If you have an idea, a hobby that you think you might make money at, that might be a great thing. I mean, I'll give you a good example. There was somebody I know who liked drawing cards. She used to give people personalized postcards, and she put a little painting on them. And all of a sudden, her friends were saying, yeah, I like this. Can I buy some of these for you? And she said, sure. And then she made more, and then the friends would recommend other friends. And before she knew it, she had a whole business making postcards for people. You know, take what you like to do or what you know about. That's the best way. And to try and, you know, make that into a profitable endeavor. But this, even if you don't know about it, as I said, there are plenty of franchises, there's network marketing companies, things like this, that will train you on how to do what you need to do.
Well, by the way, I would love to spend a lot more time on all the benefits, the tax benefits of a small home-based business, which is to a large extent of what Lower Your Taxes Big Time is. Again, that's Lower Your Taxes Big Time by Sandy Botkin. And his other book that is probably more for the investors or people who are not so interested in starting your own business is Achieve Financial Freedom. But as much as I would like to talk about some of those things, I would like to talk about some of the other things that you talk about, because one of the big ones that really kind of smacked me in the face, because we do it, but we don't probably do it as often as we should or recommend it as aggressively we should. And it's on page 46 where you talk about income shifting, because you almost seem like this should be a routine type transaction, and I'd say not more than a couple people out of 100 do it. So can you tell us a little bit about both the gift and shift tax technique and some of the things that that investors who are buying and selling stocks and incurring gains, some of the things that they can do to reduce their taxes, and why don't we assume for discussion's sake that they are in a family where husband trusts wife who trusts kids.
Okay. First, I do want to mention that my other book, Achieve Financial Freedom Big Time, is not just for investors. It's for anyone, really anyone, but it's very different. Instead of being tax-oriented, it deals with things like estate planning and probate and asset protection and what mortgages to buy, a lot of nitty-gritty economic financial issues that people, you know, what college did you go to? Should you spend? What kind of debt should you have? Things like that. A lot of little nitty-gritty stuff. But anyway, let's talk about income shifting. You know, when I was at Deloitte Touche, people used to pay us thousands for the information that I provided in my book and we'll be mentioning today. Because you're right, very few people are doing this. And among there's two essential techniques. There's a lot of techniques in income shifting, but two of them that I want to mention for sure is the gift to push tax technique. Now, what is this? Bet you no one has ever heard of it. This really started as a loophole that was created by the Bush administration. And it was continued by Obama and the current Congress. The way it works is that normally when you sell stocks, bonds, real estate, mutual funds, things like this, and you get long-term capital gains, you pay usually between 15 to as much as 23.8% on as a capital gains tax when you sell those things, plus state. That's in addition to any state tax you might pay. What Congress did is they said, all right, for someone who's not in the 15% bracket, something less than that, that means if you're filing a joint return, you're netting out net of your taxable income somewhere under about $72,000, and if you're a single individual, it's around $37,000 or so, somewhere in that range. If you're less than the 15% bracket and you sell stocks, bonds, real estate, somewhat like that, your capital gains rate will be zero. You actually pay no tax on your long-term capital gains. Now, why is that important? Here's why. Instead of selling the stocks and the bonds and the real estate and all that other stuff and paying capital gains tax of 15 to 23%, you simply give away the stock or the bond or the real estate to relatives that you're supporting. It could be your children. It could be your grandchildren, nieces, nephews, mothers, brothers, anybody you would support anyway. And then they sell the stock or the bond or the real estate one day later. Here's my point. You're in the 15 to the 23.8% bracket. Your relatives could be in the 0% bracket if they net under $72,000 joint or $37,000 single. You could literally wipe out your capital gains taxes by doing that. And that's called the gift to push tax technique. Now, the rich have been doing this for years. This was the best indoor game in town since Monopoly. However, Congress tried to limit this recently. And the way they tried to limit it was something called the kiddie tax. Now, what's the kiddie tax? Children, or anybody for this matter, who is under age 24 and is full-time students and unmarried can earn up to $2,000 of investment earnings. That includes capital gains. Investment earnings taxed at their bracket, which, by the way, is probably zero. Anything above $2,000 is taxed at the highest bracket of the parent. That applies to anyone who's under 24, full-time students, and unmarried. If they're not 24, or if they're not a full-time student, or if they are married, then this age drops to age 18. So it's 18 or over, they're taxed at their own bracket. And that's called the gift-to-push tax technique. So what do you do if you have three kids, and they're all full-time students, and they're under 24? Well, then you can shift up to $2,000 of earnings to each kid tax-free. So if you have three kids, you can shift $6,000 that way. So it still works. It just doesn't work as much as well as it did many years ago.
I don't know if people are really kind of getting this. This is a way that you can really basically have capital gains free taxes for your capital gains.
That's absolutely correct.
And you know, particularly, it's even easier if your kid is older than 24. But Sandy's actually given us a way to at least limit the capital gains, even if our kids are less than 24 or in college.
I mean, absolutely. Let me give you a good example. I was on the plane with a gentleman who was an attorney, and he makes a lot of money. He's a labor attorney, and he makes a lot of investments in the stock market that do very well. You know, I got the feeling that he gets inside tips. I can't prove it, but I think he does. But anyway, he has some kids, and I asked him, what do your kids do? Well, they go to University of Southern California. One goes to UCLA. And I said, well, how do you pay for the tuition? He said, I pay by check. And I looked at him and I said, well, you know, that's a really dumb thing to do. He goes, why? I said, look, give your kids the stock. As long as their net taxable income is under roughly $37,000, all the gain on that stock is capital gains free. The only thing they'll have to pay tax on maybe is California, which is where he's from. You're in the 23.8% capital gains bracket, federal tax bracket. They'll be in the 0% capital gains bracket. You'll be able to shift about $37,000 of capital gains tax-free to them that they can use to pay for their education. You give them a check for the difference. And when he was so excited, he wanted to know how to get the rest of my program. He wanted to know about my books. I mean, even wealthy people are not always getting this information.
Well, see, the other thing that you mentioned earlier, you said people paid thousands of dollars, and I don't know what the cost of your books are, $10 or $20 or even $30.
But not even $30. It's about $10 or $20.
All right, boy. You know, again, the two books we're talking about, Lower Your Taxes Big Time, which is probably more for small business owners, and then Achieve Financial Freedom, both by Sandy Botkin. All right, so you mentioned that there were two income shifting techniques. And
right,
we talked about
the first
one.
That's called the gift to push tax technique. All right. The second one is actually one of the most popular financial planning strategies among doctors, particularly doctors, and movie stars. And it really came out as a result of a Supreme Court decision. And it's called the sale leaseback technique. Now, what's the sale leaseback technique, and how's that different than anything else? Unlike the first technique, where you're giving away property that has gone up in value, the sale-leaseback technique is you give away property that you've already depreciated. So you've already written it off. You're not getting much benefit of that, or you've almost written it off. Now, once it's written off, just like the gift-leaseback technique, you now, with a quitclaim deed, give away title to your property, preferably business or investment property, to people you would normally support, parents, brothers, sisters, children, grandchildren, whatever, and lease it back from them. Now, you might not appreciate this, but here's my point. You have already depreciated the property. You're now deducting the monthly lease payment you're paying your relative. You're deducting that equipment twice. And they're using that lease payment to help support them in their endeavors, whatever it is, for college. And you're getting a deduction. And even better, that deduction, if you're self-employed, will reduce your net income for Social Security. So you can reduce your Social Security that way, whereas rent is not subject to Social Security. So here they're receiving money free of Social Security, and you're getting a deduction that might reduce your Medicare and Social Security taxes. And that's called the gift leaseback technique. Now, you will need a trust there, because usually in many states you have to provide a trust, but it does work quite well. And another advantage of the sale leaseback or gift leaseback technique is that if you're ever involved in a lawsuit after that, where somebody sues you for a couple $1 million, they don't get anything from you because you've already transferred your assets out of your name. So you've asset protected yourself very cheaply.
All right, by the way, I like this, but I want to be fair and talk about some of the downsides of it, too. Number one, all right, so you are going to have to go to somebody, to presumably an attorney, to draft a trust on this. And then there's also going to be, let's call it, tax preparation complications. How large of a transaction, or how small of a transaction, either way that you want to look at it, do you think that this should be? In other words, you're not going to do this on a $5,000 piece of equipment. How
big? You'd be surprised. I'll give you an example. The general rule of thumb, from what I've seen when I worked at IRS, is a reasonable lease payment is about 40% of the fair market value of the equipment. So if you've got an equipment worth $5,000, if you sell it today, you can lease it back for about 40% a year for about $2,000. You get a deduction of that for $2,000. A $2,000 deduction pays an awful lot. Goes considerably along with paying any kind of legal fees for the trust, or accounting fees for the trust, which isn't that expensive. Secondly, when they draft up the trust, it's only a one-time thing. It's not like they do it every single year.
Well, this is a really interesting thing that very few people think about, and this might be particularly appropriate for people that have fully depreciated property, particularly real estate or business property, where they're not getting a deduction, and now they're actually going to get income shifting.
Think about doctors. The number one concern by every doctor I've ever met is liability. By using the gift the sale leaseback technique, or even the gift leaseback technique, all the equipment that's in their office or in their practice, they get out of their name. So if somebody sues them for malpractice, they can still use the equipment, and they've achieved asset protection here, and it's a very cheap form of asset protection.
All right, and then the other thing that I do feel honor bound to mention is, it's not a good idea to do this if you're about to die, because then what's going to happen is you're going to lose your step up in basis.
Yeah, that is absolutely correct. Yeah, right. If you're, you know, but you know what? I can't speak for you, but I plan on living forever or die trying.
Well, but realistically, so I guess my point
is, you're terminal, and you don't have long to live. This may not be a good idea, because at least when you pass away, you get a full step up in basis, which means it doesn't matter what you paid for it. The value to your heirs becomes the fair market value as of date of death. But even that you have to question. There's some right now. Congress is looking at some tax reform, and one of the things they're looking at is avoiding the step up in basis upon estate planning.
Right, but at least for right now, in fact, that's one of the greatest things. Excuse me, about the step up in basis for real estate. So let's say dad depreciates the property down to near nothing and then dies, leaving it to kids, and then kids start depreciating it again. So
that's right. They could sell the property and not pay any tax or start depreciating it again. That is absolutely correct.
Right. So the sale-leaseback technique, I think, sounds really good for a lot of people. Frankly, you gave me a lower transaction amount than I would have guessed. To me, $5,000 wouldn't have been enough, but you're saying, hey, it's not that expensive to set it up, and B, the tax complications aren't that bad, and C, once you do set it up, it's a continued tax deduction, creditor protection technique that can just go on for years.
That's correct. There's a lot of, I mean, obviously you want to see a lawyer and get an evaluation on this or some tax professional, but I think it's well worth it, even for $5,000. And a lot of people, like doctors and other people, have lots of equipment, not just $5,000. And I want to emphasize something here. This works also with real estate. You know, a lot of times, let me give you just a couple of tips with real estate. There's most real estate, I don't know if you own any real estate. I own where people live, lodging facilities. And real estate consists of both real estate and personal property. For example, in my properties, includes washer, dryers, refrigerators, stoves. All that stuff gets depreciated separately from the property. And after you write it off, you can actually give away that property in trust with a quitclaim deed and lease it back from the trust. And now the money comes out of the trust and goes into your kid's name or grandkid's name and use it for their education. So this certainly works on real estate. Another big advantage, which is something I bet you never even thought of, and I'd like to share with your guests, this is a very sophisticated little bit of tax planning, is that when you buy investment property, I don't care if it's commercial property, residential property, any investment property, you have to make an allocation between the building and the land, because the building is depreciable, the land is not. And you can make the allocation based on the appraiser's allocation, you can hire your own appraiser to make an allocation, but you have to make an allocation. Wouldn't it be great if you could write off the land, which normally is not depreciable? And with this technique, you can, because what you can do is you can actually divide the title. In lawyers, we call it bifurcate the title. You can put the title of the land in the trust and lease the land back from the trust for your kids. And this way, that you're depreciating the building, you're now deducting the lease payment on the land, you're writing off 100% of the property. And even better, if IRS audits you and says, oh, we don't like this allocation, you can always respond, well, I'll take any allocation you want, because then we'll just increase the lease payment.
Sandy, we've talked a little bit about your books so far. Tell us about TaxBot. We understand you have an app available for smartphones.
Well, you know, one of the things I've realized is that there's a lot of people out there that need to keep track of their expenses and mileage. It's true for self-employed people. It's true for corporations that own cars. It's true for employees that have to submit reimbursements to their employer. And yet people aren't doing it. They're just not keeping their records correctly. They're not compliant in many, many cases. I would say certainly over 95% of the people I've seen are not compliant, and most of them don't even know they're not compliant. That's even the worst part of it. So we designed something very simple. You know, one thing I don't like to document. I don't. I do it because it saves me money, but I don't like it any more than anybody else. But if it's simple, easy, and fast, I'll do it. So I designed something for me with two buttons. It's called TaxBot. It goes on the iPhone, the Droid, it's an app, Droid tablet. It can work on the iPad, the web. I mean, it works on all those things. And what it does, it has essentially four things. It has a mileage tracker with a GPS system, so that the minute you start moving over 5 miles an hour, the mileage tracking automatically goes on, and the minute you stop for more than 5 minutes, it'll turn off and automatically give you everything that IRS requires, the beginning address, the ending address, the mileage, the date. It'll even do it round trip for you. All you type in is whether it's business or personal. You just click a box, actually. You don't even type that in. And put in the reason. And that's it. and then you save everything up on the web, and it stores it for you and summarizes it for you. The second thing, it has expense tracking. It has all, so every time you have a lunch or travel or anything like that, all the tax questions that IRS requires for who, what, when, where, why, and how much pop up. So by filling it out, you avoid procrastination and you avoid any problem with the IRS. And so how would that feel to be bulletproof?
Well, it sounds good. But Sandy, let's say that I'm saying, hey, I'm a busy guy. And yeah, maybe I miss a couple deductions, but my time is more valuable. How would you answer somebody like that who isn't, by the way, myself included, somebody who isn't really historically great about tracking this kind of stuff? Now, not that I want to piss away money, but I don't want to just spend half my life being a bookkeeper. How would you answer that?
Well, you know, our studies have shown that this is something that really should bring into mind here. Most people think they save money. They know this viscerally. They save money when they document correctly and they keep the government off their back. But they don't realize how much they save. We've done some studies, and we found that for every minute you spend in documenting your expenses correctly, you save approximately, it's worth about $120 a minute for every minute that you spend documenting. That's what, $3,600 an hour? I can't imagine too many people are making more than $3,600 an hour of work. And with TaxBot, by the way, I do want to mention that we also have an integrated camera for receipts, because IRS just announced that they'll take digital documentation. Doesn't have to be paper, so you can get rid of that paper. Just take a picture of it, and then we have a whole library of blogs and videos and all kinds of things, tax and financial topics, that I put in TaxBot, so people can save thousands, and that's the reason we did it.
All right, and so how could people get this?
TaxBot, you can go on the iPhone store or the Droid store and download the app. It's called TaxBot, TaxBot. It's only $9.95 a month for all of this. And if you do it for the year, I think it's $99 a year, and save yourself 2 months. It even comes with a guarantee. I mean, if you don't generate a minimum of 20 times what you paid in the first month alone, what's that, 2,000% rate of return, we'll give you back all your money. So, I mean, you can't beat that.
By the way, for whatever it's worth, I am a buyer of, you know, books and information and other things and tapes and CDs and all types of information things, but I'm not a huge app buyer. This one I'm going to buy.
Yeah, it's a good app.
All right. Anyway, the next area that I want to talk about, and I guess you touch about this in both of your books, again, Lower Your Taxes Big Time, and which is probably more for some self-employed people and people looking for some tax tips, which we touched on earlier, but then also Achieve Financial Freedom, both by Sandy Botkin. But one of the things that you have always been good at is helping people reduce the cost of college. And I don't necessarily mean by going to a less expensive school, although I know that that's part of your paradigm also. So can we talk a little bit about, maybe first, does it make sense to go to an expensive school and have the student incur $100,000 to $150,000 worth of debt? And then two, whatever school they're going to go to, if we could talk about what is the best way to pay for it, deduct it, etc. But why don't we first start on the very big picture, because this actually might be similar to something that Jim Daly told us. He is kind of like the finance expert for physicians, and he was saying, don't go to the most expensive medical school. You don't learn much anyway until you're a resident, so might as well go to a cheap one. Now I know Achieving Financial Freedom is a little bit more of an economic book also. Could you talk about the economics of going to an expensive school?
All right. My focus was on undergraduate education.
And the question sure, fair is, enough.
And then we can talk about whether, you know, you should go to the best medical school or something else, but that's something else. On undergraduate education, you know, you hear about all this stuff, and it's about you should go to the best school possible. It's just in my high school, the council is tell people, oh, go to the best college you can get into, cost be damned, and don't worry about it. You'll try. If you can't afford it, they'll find a way to give you some kind of scholarship, whatever. I mean, and this is true probably in 98% of the high schools out there in the United States. Unfortunately, that is horrible advice that they're giving these students. Horrible. Most people think, oh, if I send my kid to MIT or to Harvard or Cornell or Tufts, oh, aren't they going to come out ahead? Won't they get more job opportunities? There was actually a study done by two Princeton University professors. It was a very quiet study where they wanted to know what, over a lifetime of earnings, if somebody goes to a school like Princeton or an Ivy League versus going to a state school, assuming there were still bright kids that could have gotten in there, what their earnings would have been over their lifetime. Surprisingly, it's the same thing. whether they go to a state school or they went to an Ivy school. The earnings would have been the same for good students. So the bottom line is the earnings are the same. Why would anybody spend all this money to go to these expensive schools? And this is particularly important for incurring substantial debt. That is a disaster. You know, there's an old fun saying, debt is fun while you're incurring it, but it's never fun paying it back.
And I want to broaden this to, there's two potential people if you do go to an expensive school or even a state school for that matter, who are going to end up paying. One is the student and two is the parent. And one of the problems that I have with a lot of my clients is that let's say that they came from a home where their parents paid for their college and they always assumed that they were going to pay for their children's education. And let's assume that they're doing okay, but they're a little light on their own retirement. And they're spending $60,000-$80,000 a year for their kid to go to school, and they're going to literally have to work years longer than they would have otherwise. And this doesn't sound like a smart strategy to me.
You're absolutely right. I would never, ever recommend compromising a parent's retirement to send their kids to an expensive school. Never. You know, a lot of these kids, they say, oh, I have this dream school because they see the wonderful Ivy and they see the campus. First of all, kids don't, at that age, they don't know what a dream school is or what's important. They can't really tell. They really don't. The bottom line, the education is the same, and incurring substantial debt is a disaster. In fact, incurring substantial debt can actually result in a decrease in job opportunities. A good example of that, we met somebody who wanted to go into the movie business. Now, the way you get into the movie business is you got to basically be an intern, probably work for free or low wages until you work your way up and get connections. Well, this person got into NYU, which is one of the top schools for movie in the United States, but they incurred substantial debt. When they came out, their debt was over $100,000 in debt. There's no way that they could work as an intern to be able to pay, and then pay off that debt. There was no way. It actually resulted in a decrease in job opportunities for them. And even worse, which a lot of people don't realize, student debt can never be discharged. So before you think about incurring a lot of this debt, make sure you realize that it is very difficult to discharge student indebtedness and bankruptcy unless you are so disabled that you can't work for the rest of your life, basically. It's very difficult.
So
even worse than that.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Just finish the last point, is you're only able to deduct $2,500 a year of student loan interest. Now, when you consider that the average student loan debt is somewhere between 6% and 8%, that translates to about $35,000 of total debt. Any debt above that, you won't be able to deduct the interest. Now, if you've got to spend 6% to 8% on interest on debt you can't deduct, let me tell you, that's pretty expensive.
All right, so we have two sets of people who shouldn't necessarily go to expensive schools. One, students who don't want to incur a lot of debt, and two, parents who they might potentially be jeopardizing their own retirement because, as other writers have said, you know, you can't really borrow your retirement. So, all right, so let's assume for discussion's sake that the college has been chosen, whether it's a high cost or a state school or whatever. What are some of the tips that you can offer our listeners who might have college-age students for the best way to not just save, because I think we all know about 529 plans, which, by the way, I'm a big fan of, but some of the ways that they can reduce their taxes and some of the techniques that they might not be thinking about right now?
Well, the best planning is not when the kid's already in school, because once they're already in school and make that commitment, now you're more limited. The best planning is before they go to school. That is by far the more important, okay?
Okay, so let's say the kid's 15 for discussion's sake, or 14.
Let's take that example.
All right.
First of all, there are a couple good ways to save for college. And one of the best way, which you mentioned, are the prepaid tuition plans. And there's basically two kinds of those. One is the qualified tuition plans. One is called prepaid tuition, where you actually pay a certain amount of money to the state. And the state guarantees 4 years of tuition and its required fees, guarantees. And if you don't go to that state school, depending on the state, you'll either get your money back, or this is in Maryland, for example, there are states like Maryland, which will pay to whatever school you go to the amount of tuition that you would have had to pay to a Maryland State University.
All right.
And that's called prepaid tuition.
Let's talk about that, because I'm going to say, of the 529 plan contributions that I know about,
that's a different thing.
Right, I understand that. I understand that, but what I'm going to ask you to do is to, let's say that somebody says, hey, geez, I'm not sure which school I'm going to go to, and the parents is contemplating, gee, should I do the traditional 529 plan where they're actually not buying credits, but they're actually investing money? In Pennsylvania, they have Vanguard, which is a pretty good, very good set of low-cost index funds. Or should they be looking at the prepaid tuition plan, knowing that maybe they're not, the kid isn't going to go to the state school that you buy the credits from?
Well, first of all, a large percentage of the people do go to the state school. Let's be straight about that. But in my opinion, if they can afford it, I would do both. I would put the money away for the state school, especially if you have a state like Maryland, especially that will pay out in tuition what the tuition would have been, because that's a hell of a good investment. The other option is
Hang on a second.
You hear what I just said?
I heard the words, but I don't know them. So let's say for discussion's sake that the cost of one course is $3,000.
Let's go one step further. Let's say to go to a Maryland State University 10 years from today, the tuition would be $15,000 a semester.
Okay.
At that time, they will pay out. Let's say you go to Cornell, they will pay out $15,000 per semester of what the tuition, as I said, what the tuition would have been.
Okay, frankly, I wish I knew what Pennsylvania was. I don't. Okay, all right,
go ahead.
I
can't speak for Pennsylvania.
Right,
so
sure.
I need to understand the state. What will the state do if you don't go to a state university there? Sometimes they just give you back your money, which is not a good deal. Sometimes they will pay out, like in Maryland, what the tuition would have been, which would have been a great deal no matter what. All right? So you got to investigate as to what that rule is. Now, once you do that, then the question, I would maximize the state prepaid tuition if you have a state like Maryland. If you have a state that just gives you back your money, that's not such a great deal. Then you want to look at the Section 529 plan, which is basically like a mutual fund, and you just put away money every year, and the money is tax-free if used for qualified education, also for required fees, and the 529 can be used for other things, you know, computers, internet fees, and things like this that the prepaid tuition plan is not limited for. So that's the second way. Now, those are called qualified tuition plans, okay? The third way is hiring your kids and have them set up a Roth IRA. So you can hire your kids, and you can put away up to $5,500 of earnings, and that money can be used tax-free for their qualified education. Now, a lot of people think, well, wait a minute, I don't have a business, I could hire my kids. You don't have to hire them in business. If you hire them in business, that's great. You can write off the income. But you can hire them for personal functions. Here's a great idea, but you never even thought of. Hire them to do their bed, make their bed, do chores around the house, clean the house, put away the dishes. And you pay them a wage of, let's say, $5,500 a year. Now, that's not deductible. But they could take that money, since it is earned income, and it's probably not taxable to them because they get a standard deduction of $6,300, so they're not going to pay tax on the money. They'll take that $5,500 of that money, put it into a Roth IRA, and then all that money grows tax-free for their education. And that's use of a Roth IRA.
And even if you don't use it for their education, because you have some other interesting ways to pay for education, then they're getting $5,500, and I know you like to talk about the miracle of tax-free, tax-deferred, and better yet, tax-free compounding interest. So that's a great way to get an 18-year-old.
That's a great way. Or you can use it or even
a 15-year-old.
Retirement, which is always a good thing.
Yeah. I like that. And Sandy, what was the amount of money that it costs people not to document their or look that proactively?
Well, we have found our surveys show that roughly for every minute you put in documenting, I want everybody to think about this, it will put about $120 in deductions in your pocket every minute.
$120, so that's $3,600
An hour.
Well,
deductions. That's correct.
Now, some people complain about my rate, but I'm nowhere near that. So
nowhere near that.
Okay. So anyway, you were talking about an alternative method. You mentioned the idea of hiring your kid, which I really like that idea. In fact, my daughter's actually doing some work for me right now, and I am going to pay her, and then she can take that $5,500 and use it to fund a Roth IRA. But you had another technique that you wanted to talk about before we had to go for break.
Right. Well, now with hiring, you can also hire them in your business, in which case then you get a deduction, and they get that money tax-free, up to $6,300, which they can use for their education and so on. All right, let's talk about some other ways to reduce the cost of college. One of the best ways, which is a lot of people don't know about, is how do you get in-state tuition for an out-of-state kid? Think about that. And one of the best ways you can do this is to apply to what I call the academic college common market. A lot of states have programs they set up with each other so that if you have a major, if your kid has a major that is not available in your state, you can go to a related state and get that major, so you can study that major at in-state tuition rates. And there are various things, like the New England Board of Higher Education represents a lot of the New England states. The Midwestern Higher Education Compact represents a lot of Midwestern states. Maryland and some others in Alabama are in the Southern Regional Board. So the point is, if you have a major that is not available by any state university in your state, you can go to these related state universities at in-state rates. So that's one way to get in-state tuition.
Do you have a source for where somebody could find that?
It's in my book. I got a whole discussion on this in Achieve Financial Freedom Big Time, page 54, on all the various markets and all the various exchanges that allow you to take courses at in-state rates.
And by the way, for people listening, if you buy either Lower Your Taxes Big Time or Achieve Financial Freedom and you aren't happy, I will personally refund your money, because it is impossible for you to buy one of these books, spend 10 minutes with it, and not come out with 100 times your investment. That's I believe that. But anyway, go ahead.
You know, I'll tell you an interesting story. You know, you kind of wonder, with all these great books out there, why don't we have a lot more people who are rich and aren't in substantial debt and doing very well? Here's an interesting statistic. You take all the tax planning and financial planning books sold in the United States, all of them combined, they don't outsell the lowest selling Harry Potter book. Think about that.
Including mine. And unfortunately, yes, including yours, too.
That's correct. There's a reason people are poor, unfortunately. And it's not due to lack of information available. All right. How else do you get in-state tuition? Here's a technique that I personally use. So I'm going to give you a technique that worked for me, in personal.
Now, by the way, do you realize how gutsy this is?
Yeah.
I mean, for our listeners. So he's basically, like, flaunting the IRS, saying, hey, this is what I did personally, and you can audit me, and I feel so confident about it that I'm just going to stand up to the audit.
I'm not flaunting the IRS. I'm flaunting the universities.
Okay.
A lot of this depends on from school to school and how to get independent status. Different schools have different rules. But most of them will allow you in-state status if you can establish that you are independent of your parents. Now, what does that mean, independent of your parents? What that means is that you're paying your own rent, you're paying your own tuition, you're paying your own room and board, you get the title to your car and voter's registration to show that you intended to establish residency in that state. And by showing independence and by intent to establish residency, many times you can get in-state tuition for an out-of-state kid. And I did this with my daughter. My daughter went to an Ohio State University. In-state tuition was at that time was about $9,000 a year, whereas if you go for an out-of-state kid, you're talking $24,000 a year. Big difference, okay? But what we did is we transferred a bunch of money for my daughter's education before she went to the college. Now, once she enrolled in college, she paid her own tuition for the first year. She paid her own room and board. She got a driver's registration in Ohio. She got her voter's registration in Ohio to show that she wanted to be a domicile. All of her expenses were personal, paid by check. Everything was to be shown. At the end of the first year, we applied for in-state tuition. All they asked was to, one, make sure that the checks were, that she wants to see their checking account to make sure that she paid all of her own expenses, that we didn't pay for them, and that the money was in her name before she went to the university. They actually looked back a few months before she applied to the university. By meeting those two rules and by also getting domicile, which means voter's registration and driver's license in Ohio, we were able to get in-state tuition for the rest of the years.
And how much?
Tens of thousands of dollars.
Okay, and now, if you know, earlier you said you don't have to go to an expensive school, but now you're giving us a technique to go to an expensive school without even having a high tuition or the equivalent of a state tuition.
So these academic exchanges and being an independent, establishing independent status, you could get in-state tuition for an out-of-state kid, which is a terrific deal. But again, I want to emphasize, every state, every school has different rules. And you want to look at the schools, see what the requirements are before they go there to make sure you meet the requirements. Some of them are easier than others. Like New York is very easy. So some are harder. So you want to generally check it out.
All right. So we are running out of time. But one of the things that I did want to talk about was the health savings account. And I know that you have some opinions on for people who are, let's say, self-employed. But let's assume for discussion's sake that our listeners now have a job, and let's even assume that that job has access to a health savings account. Do you think that this would be a good thing for most people to invest in and even potentially max out in?
Oh, absolutely. The health savings account, first of all, let me emphasize a couple things here. A health savings account is kind of like a, what is it? It's kind of like a bank account. You put away money every year, and you get a full deduction for that contribution. And then when the money comes out to pay for things that the insurance doesn't cover, like deductibles, eyeglasses, coinsurance, things like that, legal drugs that you get a prescription for, that money is tax-free. It's a great thing to set up. It can be set up by anybody as long as you meet certain rules. And that's the catch with the health savings account. You got to meet certain rules. One of the rules is you have to have a high deductible policy. Now, what's a high deductible policy? If you're a single individual, that means for 2015, $1,300. Your insurance has to provide $1,300 deduction or higher. If you have a family, it could be a couple, it could be a single mom with several kids, that's what this family is, then you have to have a minimum deductible of $2,600. So as long as you have a high deductible policy, you can put away $3,350 a year if you're single and $6,650 if you have a family. And if you happen to be age 55 or older and not subject to Medicare, you can put away an extra $1,000, a little more. And that's called a health savings account. I like them. They're very good. But again, you have to have a high deductible policy. Now, one good thing about that is that if you, let's say you don't use it this year, any excess can be carried over to future years and to be used for future years' payments. Now, there's one other exception to the HSA, which is very tricky, and people need to understand this. Your deductibles cannot be covered by anything else. So if you have a flexible spending account at work that covers your deductible, or if you get one of these Aflac plans that covers injury and sickness, you will not be eligible for a health savings account. You can't have anything covering, you can't have a non-qualified medical plan covering your deductibles.
Well, all right, so, but by the way, I just want to emphasize one thing that you said, and then unfortunately we're going to run out of time. But we are here with Sandy Botkin, Lower Your Taxes Big Time, which I think would be great, for particularly for people who are either in small business or thinking of starting small business, and then achieve financial freedom. But the thing that I wanted to reemphasize with the health savings account, and Jim Daly said the same thing, by the way, who is the kind of the financial guru for physicians, is that you're getting a tax deduction when you're putting money into the account, just like a traditional IRA, but it comes out income tax-free, like a Roth IRA, so it's really better than a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA.
That is absolutely right. I mean, I like the health savings accounts. There are other options available, which we don't have time to get into, like the self-insured medical plan, where you don't even have to have a high deductible. But that involves hiring family members and other things that you may not want to do.
Sandy, this has been a terrific hour. Thank you so much for your time and your wisdom and the resources that you provide people with is Lower Your Taxes Big Time, Achieve Financial Freedom, and your new app, which is?
TaxBot.
All right, and spell that, please.
TaxBot.
Okay, thank you again, Sandy.
Yeah, my pleasure. Let's make everybody's life less taxing.
Thanks for listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. Check out the show archives and listen on demand anytime at paytaxeslater.com. KQV listeners can receive free tickets to Jim Lang's Pittsburgh area workshops and more. Call the Lang Financial Group at 412-521-2732 to reserve your seats and meet Jim Lang in person, or visit paytaxeslater.com. That's paytaxeslater.com.